Welcome back to Counting to Five, a podcast about the United States Supreme Court. Last episode, we previewed a case on the court's docket this term about employee arbitration agreements. This case is actually three cases, Epic Systems v. Lewis, Ernst & Young LLP v. Morris, and NLRB v. Murphy Oil USA, that have been consolidated for a single argument at the Supreme Court on Monday, October 2nd. In this episode, I talk with Max Folkenflik, the managing partner of Folkenflik & McGarrity, who represents the employees in Ernst & Young LLP v. Morris, one of the three consolidated cases. Please keep listening after the interview for information about the upcoming Counting to Five YouTube livestream Supreme Court preview. Now on to the interview.
I'm speaking today with Max Folkenflik, the managing partner of Folkenflik & McGarrity, who represents the respondents Stephen Morris and Kelly McDaniel in the case Ernst & Young v. Morris, which is currently pending before the Supreme Court. Before we dig into the specific issue that the court will be deciding, I'd like to talk a little bit about your case and where it came from. Can you explain for the listeners what was the underlying dispute between your clients and Ernst & Young?
Well, in the simplest terms, my clients believed that they were improperly classified as exempt from overtime under the Fair Labor Standards Act. There are various exemptions under the Fair Labor Standards Act. One of the exemptions is for professional employees. My clients are accountants working for Ernst & Young, but the work that they did as junior accountants prior to being certified as certified public accountants does not match what the regulations require in order for them to be classified as, quote, professional, close quote, and exempt from overtime.
I see. So they tried to bring a class action, is that right?
Yes. This case is related to a series of cases going back to 2005 where class actions were pursued. Class actions and what is under the federal law called collective actions were pursued. And those actions did proceed forward as a class action. But during the course of that case, Ernst & Young initiated its arbitration agreement and compelled its employees to enter into that agreement as a condition of employment. And under that agreement, class actions, in fact, all actions in court are prohibited, and arbitration is required to be pursued for any claims and pursued on an individual basis only.
How did you come to be involved in this case? Were you on this case from the very beginning?
During the course of the initial case that I mentioned that was filed in 2005, which was called Ho versus Ernst & Young, I was brought onto the case by the people who were then litigating it, H. Tim Hoffman, who is the attorney for the plaintiffs in Ho. And so I joined that case and then stuck with the subsequent cases. The Morris case was initially filed in New York by me, but with Tim Hoffman also on the papers, and together with one of his colleagues, Russ Liebenson, and both of them are still on the Morris case today.
So just to make things clear for listeners, so arbitration is the process where a dispute is resolved outside of the court system by a third-party arbitrator. Can you talk a little about the arbitration agreement that was in place in this case?
Yeah, well, the arbitration agreement that Ernst & Young imposed requires individual employees to arbitrate their disputes, requires them to arbitrate individually, requires that the proceedings be maintained as confidential, which would inhibit the ability to share information among various different employees who all sort to pursue the same arbitration claims. It also has a mediation component that requires the parties to mediate to begin with before they arbitrate. So as a result of those requirements, plus some fairly extensive requirements on pre-decision discovery and the ability to have motion practice in arbitration, which is not always the case, the arbitration that's called for by Ernst & Young's agreement is potentially very expensive. And we actually litigated that in a related case called Sutherland versus Ernst & Young.
Can you explain a little bit about the Federal Arbitration Act and how that plays into this?
Yeah, well, the Federal Arbitration Act was passed in 1925, and it was enacted on a recommendation from the American Bar Association to require that arbitration agreements be enforced. Up until that time, when a dispute actually arose and a party who entered into one of those agreements sought to force arbitration, the courts would not enforce the arbitration agreement. So the Federal Arbitration Act made arbitration agreements valid and enforceable and must be enforced, except on grounds that would allow for revocation of any other contract.
Sometimes these arbitration provisions are found in consumer contracts, and there's been litigation that's gone to the Supreme Court in those contexts. Here, we're dealing with an employment context, and here there's another federal statute besides the Federal Arbitration Act that's involved, and that's the National Labor Relations Act. And I wonder if you could talk about how that comes into the case and what difference that makes.
There are actually two federal statutes. The first is the Norris-LaGuardia Act. The Norris-LaGuardia Act held that it is the public policy of the United States for employees to have the right to engage in concerted activities for their mutual aid or benefit. Following the Norris-LaGuardia Act, just a few years later, Congress passed the National Labor Relations Act. And the National Labor Relations Act actually had among it the rights given to employees by Section 7, the right to engage in concerted activities for mutual aid or protection. So that right has been interpreted by seven different circuit courts, all of whom have found in context outside of arbitration that the words of the statute are meant to include concerted activities in joint or collective litigation. And so the question here is, when you have a right to have an arbitration agreement enforced according to its terms, and then you have another right specifically for employees to engage in concerted action for their mutual aid or protection, including concerted action in court, can you have an arbitration agreement that outlaws class actions in court or arbitration?
So basically the argument is that under these labor laws, by having a provision that requires people or prohibits people, I guess, from collectively litigating or collectively arbitrating, that provision in itself would be an unfair labor practice?
That's the key phrase that you use from Section 8 of the National Labor Relations Act. We'd frame it differently. We say that it's not merely an unfair labor practice, but it's illegal. And as a result of illegality, that is ground on which a contract can be revoked or denied enforcement under public policy and longstanding federal law. And as a result of that, it fits within the exception that's contained in the Federal Arbitration Act itself, what's referred to as the saving clause. And we also believe that it's very clear under federal law that contracts that are illegal under federal law will not be enforced by the federal courts.
Let's talk a little bit about this case at the Supreme Court. This case was granted back in January, shortly before the presidential inauguration. And then after the new administration took over, there were some changes in position with the federal government. I wonder if you could talk a little about that.
Yeah, in this case, it's one of several where the Office of the Solicitor General, represented by the acting Solicitor General, Jeffrey Wall, has changed the position that the office takes with respect to these cases. One of the three cases that was consolidated is a case called Murphy Oil. And in that case, the National Labor Relations Board had initiated a proceeding and found that Murphy Oil had engaged in an unfair labor practice by having these contracts that prohibited concerted or collective litigation or arbitration. That decision then led to an enforcement action by the National Labor Relations Board and a holding that there were certain penalties and results from Murphy Oil engaging in that unfair labor practice. Murphy Oil took that case to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, and the Fifth Circuit ruled against the National Labor Relations Board and denied enforcement. At that point, consistent with the practice of litigating with federal agencies before the Supreme Court. The Office of the Solicitor General, then during the Obama administration, took the position that the National Labor Relations Board's order should be upheld. They filed a brief in the Supreme Court to have the Supreme Court review the decision of the Fifth Circuit. That petition was granted. Then after the change in administration, the Office of the Solicitor General reversed its position and now is supporting Murphy Oil and not Murphy Oil's employees. So it declined to file a brief in support of the employees and instead filed an amicus brief, that's a friend of the court brief, stating its position and arguing for the employer and not the employees. At that same time, they granted permission to the National Labor Relations Board to file its own papers in support of the employees in the Murphy Oil case. And so the National Labor Relations Board, represented by its general counsel, Dick Griffin, will be arguing in the Supreme Court.
Right. So that leaves us with an unusual situation where two different parts of the federal government are on opposite sides of this case.
That is not unheard of, but it's quite unusual. The Office of the Solicitor General is supposed to be the lawyer for the government. And as the lawyer for the government, their general position is to defend the rulings of the executive agencies, such as the National Labor Relations Board. It's very unusual because the Solicitor General is supposed to be substantially independent from the executive, from the president. They are supposed to represent the government as a whole. And so it's extremely unusual and something that the justices in the Supreme Court have reacted very critically toward in the past few cases where that's occurred. The issue here, really, the issue I think of critical importance, not just in this case, not just to employees, is what is the role of the Supreme Court when it comes to interpreting legislation as opposed to the role of the Congress? And I think the firmly established rule from the very beginning of the country is that Congress makes the laws and the court interprets them. What the employers are arguing for in this case is a rather exceptional rule that says that there's a whole lot of case law that's been through the Supreme Court and that the Supreme Court's determinations lead to a conclusion that supports the employers. But they take their eye off the ball of what Congress meant by the statutes involved. And I think that if you look at the legislation and you look at what Congress intended and don't try and distort that by talking about the policies that the court might have been in favor of, it seems almost inexorable to conclude that Congress intended that the labor laws would take priority over the Federal Arbitration Act. Now, what the employers have argued, and some lower courts have found, that the Federal Arbitration Act stands in almost an exalted position with a much higher stature than almost any other federal law. And it can only be altered or overridden by following certain rules when enacting subsequent statutes. I think that approach is inappropriate, and we think that it's fairly dangerous. The intent of Congress is, and always has been for the Supreme Court, the North Star, which they follow when they choose to interpret legislation. And I don't think the court will do anything different here. I think the employers' predictions of how strongly the Supreme Court favors arbitration, well, that may be true when they feel that that's what the legislature intends. But here, I think the legislative intent is quite clear. And I mentioned at the beginning the Norris-LaGuardia Act. The Norris-LaGuardia Act actually removes from the power of the federal courts the right to enter an order enforcing any contract that is contrary to the public policy established in the Act. And that public policy established in the Norris-LaGuardia Act is the policy to allow employees to engage in whatever concerted action they deem appropriate to advance their mutual aid or protection. And so you can't have now a federal court enforcing an arbitration agreement that defeats that right of employees. And you can't have an employer insist on entering into a contract of that type, because to do so is an interference with the rights guaranteed by the National Labor Relations Act and the public policy of the United States, as expressed in the Norris LaGuardia Act. So, you know, you really have a situation where the employers are asking the court, on the basis of what they believe to be the court's policy choices, to override the policy choices made by the legislature. And I think that the court won't do it. I think the court hasn't done that in the past and won't do that now.
As I understand it, what you're referring to is case law from the Supreme Court that suggests that in order to escape the Federal Arbitration Act, there needs to be, I think the phrase that's been used is a clear contrary command that certain things are not subject to that.
There's a lot of case law that talks about a clear congressional command to override the Federal Arbitration Act. And the employers argued that the clear congressional command meant that the Congress had to use a phrase the Supreme Court has used in the past, magical passwords, in order to overcome the Arbitration Act. They had to explicitly refer to the Federal Arbitration Act and indicate that that act should not apply to the legislation in question. When you talk about whether or not a statute that refers to litigation by implication prohibits arbitration, that's a very different kind of situation. In that situation, you want to divine what Congress intended, and their intent should be clear. When you're talking about Congress declaring something illegal, such as discrimination on the basis of race or sex, or prohibiting employees from engaging in concerted activities in furtherance of resolving workplace disputes, Congress might pass a law of that type declaring certain contracts unenforceable or illegal for a whole host of reasons without even giving a second thought to whether arbitration is available or not. So giving the power to draftsmen of arbitration agreements, to corporate lawyers who can cleverly incorporate into an arbitration clause some statute or regulation that they wish to evade, such as the requirement that you could apply to an administrative agency for relief for workplace discrimination, is something that I think Congress never intended and shouldn't be upheld. So yes, it is the clear congressional command language.
I understand that there's another twist on these arbitration provisions that's lurking out there that may not be resolved even if your side wins this case in the Supreme Court, and that's the issue of employment agreements that have an opt-out provision for the arbitration. And some courts have found that having a temporary period where employees can opt out of the arbitration provision saves them from being invalid under the NLRA. Is that something you've looked into or have any thoughts about?
My view as a general proposition is that the whole issue comes down to the question of whether there's coercion or interference, actual or implied. When the employee is looking at a contract of that type, is there any reason to believe that opting out would be disfavored by the employer and might lead to bad reviews, discharge, or some other retaliation, or just make the employee's position with the company more unfavorable? There may be situations where there is no coercion, where the employer doesn't really exercise any retaliation, or where the employer feels there is no compulsion. However, the National Labor Relations Board, I think, has taken the position clearly that those opt-out clauses would not preserve an arbitration agreement of that type, and the National Labor Relations Board's determinations are entitled to deference by the court, even if the court disagrees.
Before we finish, do you have any other thoughts about the case that you'd like to share?
I think one thought that's worth sharing is, what's the practical effect of an arbitration clause of that type being upheld? Does it merely allow the employees to pursue in a simple and expeditious fashion their claims against the employer? And that may be true as to some claims, but it's certainly not true as to these misclassification overtime cases under the Fair Labor Standards Act. In the Sutherland case, which is a case I litigated, we put in undenied proof that for Ms. Sutherland to pursue her case in individual arbitration would cost $200,000. And if she won, she would receive $1,864 in some sense. Judge Kimber Wood of the Southern District of New York said that given the economic facts, only a fanatic or an insane person would pursue a case of that type. The Supreme Court had, in a case called Italian Colors, held that in particular the antitrust laws, but by extension federal laws generally, do not have a principle that requires there to be a path to effective vindication of statutory rights. And that may be true generally, but with respect to the labor laws, the Congress has determined that workers should have the right to pursue effective vindication of their rights through concerted action. In this case, basically, what the court will be determining is not whether the cases will be pursued in arbitration or in court, but whether they will be pursued at all.
There was an article by Marcia Coyle that was talking about the oral argument and the attorneys for various parties on this case, on both sides, on your side and on the employer's side. And that article suggested that it had yet to be determined who was going to be arguing on behalf of the individual employees. Is that something you can talk to?
Yeah, I think it's likely that it's going to be Dan Ortiz. Dan Ortiz has the backing of a lot of us on the this side. He has some significant Supreme Court experience. And so there have been discussions about how to determine who would be arguing on the behalf of the employees. And it seems as if it's most likely to be Dan.
Is there anywhere that you would like to direct listeners to go if they want to know more? I see your law firm is online at fmlaw.net. Do you have any other places that you would direct people?
They can also go to SCOTUS blog and download any of the briefs they choose to read if anybody is interested in particular in the briefs we filed or the NLRB filed or Epic Systems filed or the employers filed in those cases, or the many amicus briefs. I think there are about 30 amici who have filed briefs in this case, representing almost every employer in the United States of any size. There are 20 of those, and there are about 10 briefs that were filed on our side representing employees and various other groups that have a clear interest in the outcome of the case.
SCOTUS blog is a great resource for that type of thing, and I'll definitely put a link in the show notes for this episode so people can go there and check out the briefs if they're interested. And again, this case, Ernst & Young v. Morris, along with two other consolidated cases, those are Epic Systems v. Lewis and National Labor Relations Board v. Murphy Oil USA. They'll be argued at the Supreme Court on October 2nd, the very first day of the term, first case of the first day. Thank you again for taking the time to talk with me.
My pleasure, Mike. I hope we'll get to five on this.
Well, that's the game.
That's the game.
And that brings us to the end of episode 17. At the top of the episode, I mentioned the upcoming Counting to Five YouTube live stream. It's happening this Friday, September 29th at 11 a.m. Eastern Time. A link to the live stream can be found in the episode show notes at countingto5.com or on the Counting to Five YouTube page. In this live stream, I'll be discussing each of the cases set for argument in the court's first week. I'll be previewing some of the most anticipated cases to be heard later this term. And most importantly, I'll be answering viewer questions via the YouTube live chat. If you can make it, please join me this Friday, September 29th at 11 a.m. Eastern Time. Links to other resources related to this episode can be found in the show notes at countingto5.com. That's T-O and the number 5. You can leave comments and questions on the show notes post at countingto5.com or on the Counting to 5 Facebook page, tweet at Counting to 5, or send an email to mike@countingto5.com. You can call and leave questions and comments on the Counting to 5 voicemail line at 774-226-8685. That's 774-2-COUNT-5. Your feedback helps us bring the content you want to hear. If you aren't already subscribing to Counting to 5, please subscribe now to make sure you don't miss future episodes. If Counting to 5 isn't available in your favorite podcast app, directory, or service, please let us know and we'll do what we can to get it listed. Thank you for listening. This has been Counting to 5.